I've been having some bad publicity. I don't know who might be waiting to follow me around. I'm keeping myself out of sight for now. All right. Come for lunch at 12. The next day, by 11:30, she was prepared. The table that had been set in Sarah Allersby's garden was superb. She'd had the servants lay out thick white linen, crystal glasses, and the heaviest antique silver, all part of the Guerrero house furnishings. The china was a subdued Wedgwood, cream white, with a pattern of lavender leaves and a gold rim. It was an 18th-century pattern she'd learned was in a warehouse in Mumbai that belonged to her family. She had been fond of rescuing things of that sort when she was a teenager. Old china and pottery from shipments passing through India that an ancestor had picked up. Old paintings and books from English and French houses the family had bought during times of economic disaster. Many of these things had been moved to company warehouses on the London docks, others left in place while the company leased the homes out for various purposes or converted them to hotels. The flowers in the vases were from beds not 100 feet from the table. The old Spanish-style Guerrero house was the perfect place for private conversations, a 2-story brick structure with a courtyard in the center. The tree-shaded court was protected on all sides. No remote sensing device or telephoto lens would be of much use here. Sarah looked at everything critically and with a cold eye. The food, the setting, the location of the table, even the likely path of the sun had to be right. Men like Diego San Martin had little tolerance for inconvenience. At exactly noon, her front doorman, Victor, ushered San Martin through the foyer and the French doors into the courtyard, where Sarah awaited him. He was about 55, but he was vain about his appearance and kept himself in fighting condition. He carried a Panama hat with a black band and wore a beige linen suit with a pale yellow shirt and blue tie. He looked cool and sweet, Sarah thought, like an Italian ice. He was followed in by 2 bodyguards. She admired the easy, casual way San Martin traveled about with bodyguards. He was never hampered or hemmed in by their presence. When he arrived at a building, one of them would step in first, look around, and open the door for him. When San Martin entered a room, one man stayed at the door to keep it securely under his control, and the other stationed himself at a second strategic spot, beside a window or by a staircase, away from the civilians. San Martin always behaved as though the 2 ice-eyed killers were invisible. He took Sarah's hand and leaned in to kiss her cheek. "It's wonderful to see a beautiful and noble lady at any time, but to be invited to her home for lunch is a great privilege, and the light here is made for you." Sarah Allersby would never say it, but it had been made for her. She'd had the long table removed today and replaced with a round one because she didn't want to set off any thoughts of precedence. A man like San Martin would expect to sit at the head of any table, but letting him do it here would be dangerous. He instinctively took charge of things, and she could not let him begin to think of her as an underling in his empire, or of her house as territory. "Please, sit here," she said, and pulled the chair out. She moved to the chair beside that one, knowing that it would make the place she'd chosen for him desirable. Once they were comfortably seated side by side, she nodded, and the waiter poured some wine for both of them. She tasted it, then said, "Leave us. I'll ring." The waiter moved off toward the kitchen. She said, "I've invited a trusted associate who's waiting in the library. His name is Mr. Russell. May I bring him in?"
"All right." San Martin turned toward his 2 bodyguards to be sure they'd heard. They said nothing but headed into the house and across the foyer. After about a minute, they returned with Russell and resumed their posts. Sarah said, "This is Mr. Russell, and this is Mr. San Martin. Diego, Mr. Russell has helped me and members of my family a number of times, and his discretion is absolute. I wouldn't invite him today if I didn't trust him with my life." Diego San Martin took the wine bottle out of the ice bucket and looked hard at Russell. Sarah looked hard at Russell, too, imagining what San Martin was thinking. Was she imagining just a faint tinge of blue remained on his face? Russell picked up his wine glass and held it out so San Martin could fill it. Both men's faces were empty and serious, each staring into the other's eyes. Neither man's hand shook. "Thank you," said Russell.
"Well, gentlemen," said Sarah, "while we are having a chilled drink together, let me bring out my problem, and then I'll ring to have the food served."
"Excellent idea," said San Martin, "right to the point."
"A few weeks ago, an American couple named Sam and Remy Fargo began to spy on me. They went into the country around the Estancia Guerrero, and then onto the Estancia itself. They were the ones your security people saw near the sacred cenote in the ruins of the ceremonial center. I believe they wounded or killed about a dozen of your employees."
"Yes," San Martin said. "Their visit was an expensive one for me."
"They also visited the Estancia itself and saw your marijuana crop and the coca trees. They came to this house to complain about them to me."
"Interesting. They have also gone to some trouble to get me arrested on the charge of stealing a Mayan codex from them and for attempting to have them killed by Mr. Russell. I had the charges dropped, but only after days of humiliation and a public court appearance."
San Martin sipped his wine.
"That must have been unpleasant."
"Yes. They're a potential threat to me, so I'm afraid to let them go on this way. But they're even more of a threat to you. They've already found your operation on the Estancia. I know you feel people should solve their own problems instead of bringing them to you. But I think these people are a problem we share."
He laughed.
"You've learned to know me so well," he said. "You're a perceptive woman. You may actually be the perfect woman."
She laughed too.
"Of course I am. Being a woman is all I do."
She refilled the glasses.
"All right. Tell me how I can be a good friend to you, and then we'll have lunch. I promise to give you my answer when we've finished."
"Mr. Russell, can you help me explain?"
Russell was filled with appreciation of her cunning. She knew that San Martin would be most comfortable with her as the ultra-feminine woman who appeared not to know the violent details. He also knew that San Martin had no interest in knowing him, so he had to be brief. "Miss Allersby has a list of Mayan sites that she planned to visit. At one of these sites, we had a group of 5 men clear and guard a helicopter landing area so Miss Allersby could bring journalists with her to see the ruins. The men were heavily armed, yet they had disappeared by the time Miss Allersby arrived. And we now know that the Fargos visited the site before she did."
"Thank you," said San Martin. He turned to Sarah.
"And now let's do justice to your beautiful table and have the lunch you've planned."
Sarah rang the little silver bell by her, and the lunch was served. There was poached salmon with a caper sauce and asparagus. The wine that was poured with it was a 1998 Veuve Clicquot Le Grand Dame. There was sorbet to cleanse the palate before the salad was served, in the French manner, after the entree, and then small, delicate pastries with strong espresso. As Señor San Martin finished his coffee, he sat back in his chair. Sarah Allersby looked at the servants, gave a little flip of her hand, and they dissolved into the doorways along the side of the house that led to the kitchen and pantry. Then she poured another cup of espresso for San Martin. San Martin looked at Russell with eyes so cold and devoid of feeling that they looked dead.
"I'll try to find out what happened to your 5 men. The forest is a dangerous place, and not everybody with a gun works for me. If the Fargos are responsible, the 5 might be in jail somewhere. He handed Russell his calling card. "Here, Mr. Russell. Come and see me tomorrow afternoon. I'll supply you with a small army of professionals who won't be troubled by a couple of American tourists."
Chapter 26, Alta Verapaz, Guatemala. Sam and Remy loaded their backpacks into a jeep. This time it was a rental car and a few years newer. They drove the narrow, winding road toward Santa Maria de los Montañas, the town where they had jumped off the marijuana truck and been helped by the priest and the doctor. As they drove, Remy said, "Do you think we're having an effect on her?"
"Sarah Allersby?" Sam said. "I'm sure we are. We visited the 6 biggest and probably most important undiscovered sites mentioned in the Codex and registered them. That burns them for her. She can't claim to discover them if we did." Sam drove on for a minute. "The police in Belize say the 5 men who attacked Tim's helicopter haven't talked yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if she hired them to control access to that Mayan site."
Remy said, "I know she's angry. In fact, if nothing else had happened, seeing herself ridiculed in the European magazines would have been plenty. People envy the rich, bad girl celebrities who are always in the tabloids, but envy isn't the same as admiration. There's a complicated mixture of feelings involved. Whenever one of these women gets embarrassed or hurt, a lot of the people who were busy fawning on them are delighted to see it happen."
"She's pretty sophisticated. The fickleness of crowds can't be a surprise to someone like her."
"I know," said Remy. "I've just been thinking about her and feel this isn't going right. We're locked in a competition with her, and I'd like to be able to foresee a happy ending, but I don't."
Sam said, "The ideal end would be if she would stop pretending to be an archaeologist and send the codex she stole to the Mexican government."
"Of course. But do you honestly think we'll wear her down enough for that?"
"Not likely," he said.
"So maybe what we ought to be doing is thinking of ways to steal the codex back and return it ourselves," said Remy.
"I have been."
"Really? What have you thought of?"
"I'm stuck on phase 1, finding out where she keeps it." In the afternoon, Sam and Remy approached Santa Maria de los Montañas in the only way possible, from the road that rose drastically upward from the valley below. The jeep climbed back and forth up the hairpin curves, unprotected by guardrails, followed by a long straight rise through thick forest to the crest. The trees on the forested upper altitudes kept drivers from seeing much of the road ahead. When they were nearly to the last stretch of road before the rise, Remy pointed at a spot that was bare except for bushes and brush.
"I think that was the place where you landed when we jumped off the marijuana truck. Want to do it again in daylight so I can get a picture for my scrapbook?"
"Thanks for offering, but I think I won't have trouble remembering."
"Suit yourself," said Remy. "Can we stop at the church and see Father Gomez?"
"I think we have to," Sam said. "We said we'd let him know how our meeting with Sarah Allersby went." When they reached the top of the hill, they parked on the plaza near the old church, then walked to the small house behind it that served as the priest's home and office, and knocked. In a moment, Father Gomez appeared at the door. He smiled.
"Señor and Señora Fargo, I'm delighted to see you again."
"Thank you, Father," said Sam. "We thought we'd stop by for a talk." Father Gomez said,
"I can tell from your serious expression that the news will not bring me joy. But we must talk. Do you have time to have tea with me?"
"Of course," said Remy. "We'd be delighted."
Come in,"
he said, and ushered them into his simple office with its dark wooden furniture. If it weren't for the open laptop computer, the room could have been from the 16th century. He led them into a small, old-fashioned dining room with a long table in the same dark, heavy wood. An elderly lady with brown skin, pronounced Mayan features, and her gray hair tied in a tight bun entered the room.
Father Gomez said, "Señora Velázquez, this is Señor Fargo and Señora Fargo. They'll be joining us for tea."
Senora Velasquez brought out plain white china and utensils, which Father Gomez and the Fargos arranged on the table. After Senora Velasquez brought the tea and cookies, she returned to the kitchen.
"Won't Senora Velasquez join us?" asked Remy.
"It's not her custom," Father Gomez said. "In a small town parish, when people meet with the priest, they lack privacy. Please, Senora Fargo, will you pour for us?"
"I'm happy to," Remy said.
She took over the ceremonial role, pouring the tea and distributing the cups on saucers.
"Now," said Father Gomez, "are you ready to tell me what happened when you went to visit Miss Ellersby?"
Remy and Sam told him the whole story, beginning with Sarah Ellersby's visit to their house to buy the Mayan Codex, and ending with the ambush that awaited them at the burned landing patch outside the ancient Mayan city. "We've learned a lot about Sarah Ellersby. She intends to use the map in the Mayan Codex to locate and pretend to discover all of the most promising sites. We're using the same information from Father Las Casas's copy to get to each of the sites first. A professor at the University of California in San Diego uses our photographs and GPS data to register them with the international archaeological organizations before she can reach them." Father Gomez looked troubled.
"I'm sorry that she has turned out to be such a selfish, misguided woman. Do you think the authorities will force her to stop letting narcotics traffickers use her land?"
Sam sighed. "I'm told by responsible people in Guatemala City that things will get better in time. The existence of the Mayan site near the fields is known now, and the fields themselves have been drawn to the attention of the national police. But improvements happen slowly, and Miss Ellersby has some powerful friends who can make it even slower."
"It was good of you to come all the way back here to report this to me," said Father Gomez.
Sam held up both hands. "No, please. That wasn't the only reason we're here." Remy said,
"We told you that we were rushing to verify, photograph, and register the Mayan sites in the Codex. That's the other reason why we're here."
"Here?"
Father Gomez looked shocked.
"Not in Santa Maria de los Montañas?"
"Not in the town," said Sam. "We think it's above the town on a plateau. The map shows it as something that looks like a tower or a fort."
"Very interesting," said Father Gomez.
He looked uneasy.
"Would you please allow me to hire a guide for you? I'd hate to have you get lost up in these hills."
"No, thank you, Father. We have the precise location on GPS and also aerial photographs," said Remy.
"We're getting good at finding these places. What would be helpful is if you could tell us where we can store our car safely."
"Yes, of course," he said. "There's Pepe Rubio's garage. He's the town's mechanic and keeps cars overnight quite often."
"That sounds perfect," said Sam. "He can give us an oil change at the same time." Remy stood and began clearing the plates from the dining table while Sam and Father Gomez chatted. As she entered the kitchen, she caught Senora Velasquez stepping back from the door as though she had been eavesdropping. Remy smiled and handed her the plates, but Senora Velasquez didn't return the smile. They set out from the priest's house, and Remy told Sam about Senora Velasquez.
"I'm sure she was listening," said Remy.
"No harm done. We would have been happy to have her join in the conversation."
"I know. But I'll bet a lot of people around here wonder how their secrets get out."
Soon they found Pepe's garage. They could see they had the right place from the cars parked all over the block and in front of the house. They found Pepe putting on a set of tires. Sam hired him to service their car and keep it safe. Pepe referred them to the nearby house of the Perez family, who were willing to rent them a guest room for the night. In the evening, they ate at the small restaurant where they'd had breakfast with Father Gomez and Dr. Huerta on their first visit. The following morning, as the sun grew bright, they set out on foot to find the structure they'd seen on the map in the Mayan Codex. It was a beautiful day as they crossed the fields, cleared for planting corn and beans, and then entered the forest.
After some searching, they found a path that led up the side of the plateau, above and beyond the town. After climbing about 100 feet on the path, Remy stopped.
"Look at this."
She stood at a place where the path turned upward and to the left. There was a steep incline to the next level, but they could see that it had been reinforced with slabs of rock laid horizontally, like giant steps.
"I guess this means we've found the right trail," Sam said. He joined her in climbing toward the turn ahead.
"That's right," she said. "But in all the other sites we've visited, the stone was all overgrown. This is exposed."
They walked along the path, climbing steadily. Sam said, "This is closer to a place where people live than the other sites were. And it does make sense to use a perfectly good path when you find one instead of blazing a new trail."
They climbed for a while, unimpeded by thick brush or centuries of fallen earth.
Remy said, "The part I haven't figured out yet is why."
"I know," Sam said. "Maybe there's something else up there. Good fields or something."
"I'd hate to carry the harvest down this path," Remy said.
"Then what do you think it could be?"
"I'm hoping it's a shortcut to another village that has an air-conditioned spa and restaurant."
"A good working theory," he said. "I'll accept it until we find something better. That's the way we scientists operate."
In 10 more minutes, they reached the head of the path. They climbed up onto the level top of the plateau and looked around. There were several large mounds of earth that might be buildings, but they were not on the scale of the buildings in the cities they had found. They weren't high or steep, and the plateau wasn't large enough for monumental architecture. It was only about 300 feet across.
They both noticed something else. The perimeter of the plateau had a low ridge around it like the rim of a bowl.
They walked along the ridge, taking pictures, and then Sam stopped at a section that had fallen down. It revealed the ridge to actually be a pile of stones and earth.
"It's a wall.
It's like the old Roman forts you find in Europe. Low walls of stone piled up to stop an enemy attack. This was built for a battle."
"It's not like any of the other ruins we visited," Remy said. "It feels different. Not empty, somehow."
They walked the rest of the way around the plateau. In the middle of the flat space, there were more low mounds of earth and stone, all of them overgrown with small plants. The only sounds on the plateau were the movements of the leaves in the soft wind and the calls of birds. At times, it was so quiet that Sam's and Remy's footsteps were the loudest sounds. Remy said, "This isn't a place where people would live. It reminds me of the cenote a few miles from here. The wall around it seems to be made for a last stand, too."
"I know what you mean," said Sam. "This and the cenote must be relics of a war between cities."
They came across a trench about 3 feet deep and only wide enough for a man to stand in it and dig. It ran from the stone wall at the rim of the plateau for about 100 feet and directly into one of the mounds.
"Uh-oh," said Remy.
"Do you know what that is?"
"I think it's the kind of trench that pot hunters and grave robbers dig to find underground chambers and caches."
Sam raised his satellite phone and took a few pictures of it, then sent them to Selma. He and Remy walked along the trench looking into it.
"If that's what it was, it seems to have failed. It doesn't lead to a bigger hole where they might have found something and dug it up."
The trench stopped at the base of the mound. When they reached the spot, Remy said, "It doesn't seem to have stopped here. The rocks that are piled on the side of the mound are different. I think somebody dug into the mound and then covered the hole after they were done."
"It's puzzling," said Sam. "The word is creepy," Remy said.
"Creepy, then."
He bent and began to lift the stones that had been placed in the opening and toss them to one side.
"You're going to dig into it? That's not why we came here. We were just locating sites, photographing them, and describing what's in them so David Kane can register them."
"I can't very well describe what's here unless I know," said Sam. "This could be anything."
"It could be a tomb.
Judging from the trench, that's what whoever beat us here thought. Or it could be a pile of the right-sized rocks for throwing down at invaders, or a big pile of potsherds, which, as you know, is the most common find at any archaeological site.
Remy sighed, knelt beside Sam, and began lifting stones from the mound and tossing them aside. They worked until the stones revealed the straight, even sides of an entrance.
A doorway, she said.
So much for the rock pile theory and the broken pot theory.
Still have a bad feeling?
More and more, said Remy.
I'm just going along with this to show you what a great sport I am.
We're almost in, Sam said.
Remy stepped back from the opening and let Sam haul the last few rocks away. Then he said, "We're in."
He stood, took the flashlight from his pack, aimed it into the opening, and crawled inside.
There was silence. Remy sat still for a minute, listening. Finally, her curiosity overpowered her caution. She took her own flashlight out and entered. As soon as she was inside, she realized that the space was large and hollow. Her flashlight beam caught white stucco walls covered with realistic murals of old Mayans. There were many glyphs, and between them were pictures of dozens of men in feathered headdresses and wearing jaguar skins. Some carried short spears, round shields, clubs with sharp obsidian teeth. They were going into battle. When her flashlight reached the floor, Remy jumped and gave a small cry. Lying on the other side of the chamber was a corpse. The body was in a state similar to the mummified man she and Sam had found on Volcan Tacaná in Mexico. His skin was brown and leathery, his body skeletal. He was lying near a second doorway. There were strips of cloth, a tanned belt, and boots on him, and beside him was a broad-brimmed felt hat. Sam appeared in the second doorway.
"I'm sorry. I should have warned you."
"Every day is Halloween lately," she said. She knelt by the dead man and gave him a closer look. "What do you suppose got him? The jaguar? His clothes are torn, and he has big wounds.
Take a look at his revolver."
Remy saw the old-fashioned, long-barreled revolver by his right hand. She bent low to look into the front of the cylinder and then rotated it.
"He fired all six."
"Right. And I don't see any jaguar bones."
"Do you recognize the gun?"
"It looks like a Colt single-action army, which would date it, and him, at 1873 or later."
She said, "His skull is crushed on the left side."
That was one of the details I was going to mention after we were outside in the daylight.
"This man was clubbed to death," she said. "He was murdered."
She got up, and they both walked into the inner chamber. Inside was a low bier made of cut stone. On it lay a skeleton adorned with a gold breastplate, a strip of gold with carved jade stones for a headpiece, jade earplugs. There was an obsidian knife, a club, and a large number of carved jade and beaten gold objects.
"The tomb is intact," said Remy.
"How can it possibly be intact? Whoever killed that guy out there must have known there was gold in here."
Sam and Remy both heard a shuffling sound, and then another. They stepped to the doorway. Gathered in the outer chamber were a half dozen people from the nearby town. Señora Velázquez, Pepe the mechanic, Señor Álvarez, the restaurant owner, his son, and two others they didn't know. Three of them were holding guns of some description, the others knives, and all of them looked furious. Sam said, "Hello, ladies and gentlemen." Señora Velázquez said, "Come out of there very slowly and carefully."
"We meant no harm," Remy said. "We just saw that..."
"Quiet, or you'll be as dead as he is."
Sam and Remy walked past the armed townspeople into the sunlight. Waiting in a large circle around them were about 50 other residents of Santa Maria de los Montañas. Some of them held machetes, others axes or hatchets. There were a couple of baseball bats. A few people held hunting rifles or shotguns, and there were pistols nearly as old as the one beside the man in the tomb. The menace was palpable.
The rifles and shotguns were aimed at Sam and Remy. There were two men with ropes, which seemed even more ominous than the weapons. A man they had not seen before stepped out of the crowd. He had the sun-darkened face and sinewy arms of a farmer. He looked at Sam and Remy with eyes as hard as obsidian.
"I'll volunteer to dig graves. We can throw the bodies down from here and bury them where they fall. Who will help me?"
Chapter 27. Santa Maria de los Montañas.
"I'll help dig graves."
A second man stepped forward and joined the first on the outside of the circle. After that, a couple of others just waved hands and joined the burial crew. Pepe the mechanic stepped into the circle.
"Remember, we have no reason to make these people suffer. Someone shoot them in the head with a hunting rifle and make it fast."
Sam spoke loudly.
"We would like to know why you would want to harm us at all."
He whispered to Remy, "Help me with the language."
Remy called out, "We came to your town twice. Both times we told whoever would listen what we were doing here. Yesterday we told Father Gomez what we were going to do today. We came with the most peaceful of intentions."
Señor Alvarez, the restaurant owner, said,
"I'm sorry that you have to die. Nobody here hates you. But you've found this place. It's a sacred place to us. We are not rich people, but we have a rich past. Our town was founded as part of this complex nearly 2,000 years ago. This was a refuge where the people of the city 20 miles to the east came after they were defeated in war. This mesa is one of the highest places in Alta Verapaz. The king and a few loyal survivors came here, turned, and fought. Then hundreds of years later, a period of war came again. Then again. Each time a king of the city was defeated, he and his faction fell back to this place and held out. Up here there are the remains of 5 great kings. When the Spanish soldiers came the first time, the king prepared the place one last time. But they defeated the Spanish again and again, and never needed to come here. Instead, they made peace with the priests. The watchtower on the hill was torn down and made into a church. Nobody from this town has ever betrayed its secrets."
Sam said, "This place can't be a secret forever. It's marked on a map in a Mayan codex we found on a volcano in Mexico. It's shown up on satellite photographs and been noticed by university professors."
"We don't have to let you dig up our ancestors and steal their belongings," said Señora Velázquez. "You're like Columbus and the Spanish. You think knowing about them makes them yours."
Remy said, "You don't have to let us study your special place. If you didn't want us to climb up here, you could have told us while we were with Father Gomez. We thought we were finding a place nobody knew about."
There was a roar of derisive laughter as the townspeople looked at one another with grim amusement. One of the men was angry.
"You see graves on a satellite photo and think it's all right to dig them up? It never seems to occur to you people that we know anything about the places where we've always lived. It was our ancestors who built these tombs, who made the mesa into a fortress. We've all been coming here since we were small children. Do you think we can't see walls and burial mounds? You think that if we don't dig up our ancestors and sell their treasures, we must be ignorant."
He turned away from Sam and Remy and took a rifle from one of the men near him. He cycled the bolt to load a round.
"Stop!"
The voice was powerful but strained. As everyone turned to look, Father Gomez's head rose above the rim of the plateau by the trailhead, and he took the last step up onto the plateau. He was panting and wheezing from the long, steep climb. He held up his arms.
"Stop. Don't do this. Arturo, put down that rifle. What you're about to do is just murder. It has no higher meaning."
The angry man looked at his feet, then opened the bolt of the rifle and handed it back to its owner. Father Gomez seemed to be relieved, but his expression showed he knew this was not over. Pepe, the mechanic, spoke.
"You're not from this town, Father. You're not one of us. You don't know."
A man who seemed to be a relative of Senora Velasquez said,
"Since the days of the kings, we've had nothing except this place. The walls are where brave men and women fought to their deaths, and great leaders lie inside each of these mounds. Nobody has been allowed to desecrate this place or take away what's buried here. The second king who led his people up here respected the remains of the first, and the one after that respected him."
He paused and pointed at the mound Sam and Remy had reopened.
"Only once before did a stranger make it up to this spot. He's lying in there now, although it's been more than 100 years, and nobody now alive has seen him before today. Everyone knows that he was killed by townspeople with hoes and hatchets. The secret was safe again."
"No, no, no," said Father Gomez. "I may not have been born in Santa Maria, but I've lived here longer than many who were, and I'm responsible for the state of your souls. Do you think the men who committed that murder 100 years ago aren't suffering for it in hell?"
A few people looked down at the ground, and others crossed themselves. A couple spat. Pepe said,
"We've lived for centuries at the mercy of men in Madrid or Guatemala City, signing pieces of paper to make other rulers over us and control what we have. Men who never even saw us. This is more of the same. All we're doing is trying to protect the bodies of our ancestors from the men far away who own everything."
Father Gomez took a breath to speak, but Sam said, "Hold it, Father." He turned to the people in the circle. "My wife and I had no plans to take anything away from here. The people we work with are university professors who are only interested in gaining more knowledge about the Mayan people. We are here for that reason alone. There are other people who already have maps with this spot marked. One of them is Sarah Allersby, who owns the Estancia Guerrero. Even if you kill us, she and people she hires will come to find this place. She'll dig up whatever there is and leave things looking like this." He turned and nodded toward the open trench. People were disturbed, in doubt, murmuring among themselves, while others seemed to be angrier.
Small arguments began.
A new voice came across the plateau.
"Señor Fargo is right. Listen to him."
People turned their heads to see Dr. Huerta come around the mound near the trailhead.
"What are you doing here?"
asked Señor Lopez, the storekeeper. Dr. Huerta shrugged.
"I noticed people were gone, so I asked some of your children. And over the years I've found that whenever there were a lot of people out carrying sharp objects and firearms, there has been plenty of work for a doctor."
"What are these people? Friends of yours?" asked Señor Lopez.
"This is only the second time I've seen them," Dr. Huerta said. "But I find I like them more and more. I'll show you why."
He stepped up to Sam and Remy, lifted Sam's shirt, and pulled his semi-automatic pistol from its hiding place and held it up. There was a murmur from the crowd. He released the magazine, looked at it, pushed it back, then stuck the pistol back under Sam's shirt. He lifted Remy's shirt slightly to reveal her gun.
"After all these years as a doctor, I'm good at seeing things on people that aren't part of their bodies."
He stared at the circle of townspeople.
"Some of you are eager to kill them. If they'd wanted to, they could have killed plenty of you. But they didn't want to. They were here on a friendly mission and didn't let your threats change that."
He put a hand on Sam's shoulder and the other on Remy's and began to walk them toward the trail to town.
"Stop!"
They stopped and slowly turned. It was Señor Lopez again.
"Maybe you're right, and these people should be freed. But we need time to decide what to do."
The townspeople responded with a roar composed equally of approval and relief that they didn't have to make such a momentous decision right then. The people swarmed around Dr. Huerta and the Fargos and swept them along the trail, down from the stronghold and into the town. When they reached the main street, the crowd ushered Sam and Remy into an old adobe building. There was an outer room with a table and chairs and a big, heavy wooden door. On the other side of the door was a row of three cells with thick iron bars and padlocks. The crowd pushed Sam and Remy into one of the cells, and someone locked the door and took the key. Then the people trickled back outside. After a minute, Father Gomez entered the cell block.
"Sam, Remy, I'm terribly embarrassed by this. I apologize for them. They're good people, and they'll come to their senses very soon."
"I hope so," said Sam. "Could you make sure our backpacks don't disappear?"
"They're already in the outer office. If you need anything from them, Senora Velasquez will be here to get it out for you."
"Thank you," said Remy.
"And one more thing," said Father Gomez.
He held out both hands, pushing them through the bars. Sam and Remy took their guns out from under their shirts and handed them to the priest. He put them into his coat pockets. As he left, he said,
"Thank you. I'll keep them safe for you in the church."
A minute later, Senora Velasquez opened the big wooden door, propped it open, and returned with a tray with soft drinks and glasses on it. She slid it through the feeding slot at the bottom of the bars.
"Gracias, Senora Velasquez," said Remy. "I'll bring your dinner in an hour, and I'll be outside the door all night," said Senora Velasquez. "Just shout if you need anything."
"You don't need to stay," said Sam.
"Yes, I do," she said.
She reached into her apron and held up an old but well-oiled, long-barreled .38 revolver that could have been from the 1930s.
"If you try to escape, someone has to be here to shoot you."
She put it back in her apron, took her tray, and disappeared through the doorway. After a second, the heavy wooden door swung shut. Chapter 28. Santa Maria de los Montañas. At dawn, the sun shone into the jail through a ventilation shaft, impeded only by the motionless blades of a fan. At some point in the night, Sam and Remy had fallen asleep on the two bunks, which each consisted of a shelf like a door on hinges folded against the wall during the day and lowered at night on a pair of chains that held it horizontal. Sam woke to find Remy sitting on her bunk and swinging her legs.
"Good morning," he said. "Why are you looking at me like that?"
"I was thinking how cute you are when you're lying there in your bunk," she said.
"Too bad I don't have my phone to take your picture.
You could be cellmate of the month in women's prison."
Sam sat up and pulled on his shirt, then began to button it.
"I'm flattered, I think."
"It's just an observation,
and I don't have much to look at," she said. "It doesn't look as though they use this jail much. No graffiti, not much wear and tear since the last paint job."
"Have you seen anybody yet?"
"No, but I've heard the front door close a couple of times, so we're still under guard."
A moment later, there was a loud knock on the wooden plank door at the end of the cell block. Remy smiled and called, "Come in." Senora Velasquez opened the door and came in, bearing a tray with two covered plates, some glasses of orange juice, and other good things.
"It was nice of you to knock," said Remy.
"Nobody said you can't have any privacy," said Senora Velasquez. "You just can't leave yet."
"Yet?"
"People have been listening to what Father Gomez and Dr. Huerta say about you. I think we'll all meet in the afternoon, and you can be on your way after that."
"That's a relief," said Sam. "But I'm glad they didn't let us out before breakfast. That food smells so good."
"Yes, it does," said Remy. "You're very kind to us."
Senora Velasquez slid the tray under the bars, and Sam picked it up and set it on the shelf that served as his bunk.
"I wish we had chairs and things," said Senora Velasquez.
We weren't expecting anyone like you.
Thank you for what you've done. As Senora Velasquez went out the door, there was no mistaking the sound of a big bolt being slid into place.
Just as they finished their breakfast, they heard the morning silence of the little town broken by the sound of a truck laboring up the long hill to the main street. They could hear the transmission whining, the engine's revolutions speeding up on the last 100 yards, and then the engine idling in the street in front of the church. After a moment, there was a man shouting, and then other men jumping from the truck to the pavement, and then running footsteps. Sam and Remy looked at each other. Sam stepped to the space below the tiny, high window in the wall, bent his knees, and knitted together the fingers of both his hands to make a step for Remy. She put her foot in his hands, and he lifted her up. She grasped the bars of the little window and looked out. Men in a mixture of camouflaged fatigues, T-shirts, khakis, and blue jeans ran from the truck and entered buildings along the main street. They kicked in doors and shouted at people to come out to the street. "They're rounding up the townspeople," she said. Men, women, and children came outside, looking confused and worried. They joined their friends and neighbors, adding to the growing crowd. Groups of armed men ran up the side streets and brought back more people. "They're gathering the whole town." The cab of the truck opened, and two men got out.
"It's the two men," Remy whispered.
"What two men?"
"The ones who tried to kill us for Sarah Ellersby. The ones from Spain. The one you painted blue."
"How does he look?"
"He looks sunburned, but still has a trace of a blue tinge, like a dead man."
"I can't wait to see him." Outside, Russell and Ruiz stepped to the bed of the truck, climbed up, and used it for a stage. Russell took out a thick sheaf of legal documents and handed it to Ruiz, picked up a bullhorn, and spoke.
"Testing." The word was loud, echoing from the hills. He held it for Ruiz, who read the Spanish text.
"Citizens of Santa Maria de los Montañas," he said. "Your town is situated in the middle of a tract of land that has been set aside as an archaeological preserve. In 5 days you will be removed and taken to a new town a few miles from here. You will be provided with a place to live and given employment in exchange for your cooperation."
An old man stepped out of the crowd. He wore an ill-fitting blue sport coat and an old pair of khaki pants. He stood near the truck and spoke in a loud voice.
"I am Carlos Padilla, mayor of Santa Maria."
He turned to his people.
"These men want to move us to the Estancia Guerrero. The work they offer is growing marijuana, and we would live in the barracks they built years ago when the gangsters moved in. They'll charge us more for rent than they pay us for the work, so we will always owe them money and can never leave. The land we are on has been ours for 20 centuries. Don't give it up to be slaves."
Ruiz read on into the bullhorn.
"You will all sign a paper accepting the offer of relocation, housing, and a job. Doing so will end any claim you might have to land in or around the town of Santa Maria de los Montañas."
Russell jumped down from the truck, holding a paper.
He went to old Carlos Padilla, pulled a pen from his pocket, and held it out to the old man. "Here, you can be the first to sign."
"He's trying to get the mayor to sign," Remy whispered.
The answer was loud.
"I would rather die than sign that."
One of the men from the truck waved his arm, and 4 men rushed the mayor. They slipped a loop of rope over him and tightened it under his arms, threw the end of the rope over a large limb of a tree beside the road, hoisted him up, and tied it so he hung there.
"No," Remy whispered. "No."
Sam said, "What are they doing?"
The man who had waved his arm took out a pistol and fired a round through the mayor's head. All of the witnesses, including Remy, groaned in horror.
Sam said, "What was that shot?"
"They killed the mayor."
Ruiz spoke into the bullhorn.
"Let no one move his body from this spot. We will come back in 5 days. If he's not here then, we'll hang 5 others up there in his place. If this paper is not signed by every one of you, we will put 10 who have not signed up there and ask again.
Did you understand that?
Remy whispered to Sam.
I'm afraid I did.
Russell stepped to the nearest building, which was the church. He nailed the papers to the front door. Then he and the other men climbed back into the truck. They turned around in the space in front of the church and drove back to the crest of the hill and began to coast down the long road in the direction of the estancia. The wails of women began immediately and soon reached the window of Sam and Remy's cell. Remy said, "They're gone." She jumped to the floor. A half hour later, they heard footsteps in the outer office. The blank door opened and several people filed in. Señora Velázquez, Father Gómez, Dr. Huerta, Pepe the mechanic, Señor Alvarez, the restaurant owner, and the 2 farmers who had volunteered to dig their graves. Father Gómez said,
"Do you know what happened?"
"Yes," said Remy.
Señora Velázquez unlocked their cell and they all walked through the office, where Sam's and Remy's backpacks sat. Dr. Huerta went to his office 2 doors down the street and returned with a wheeled stretcher. He wheeled it across the street to a spot below the hanging body of the mayor. He and Sam held the rope taut while one of the farmers produced a knife and cut the rope so they could lower the mayor onto the stretcher. They lifted the stretcher to straighten the legs, covered the mayor with the blanket, and pushed him to Dr. Huerta's infirmary. Many of the townspeople followed them in, and others stood outside. Inside the office, Remy said, "Is there a regional government to handle this?"
"Not one with troops," said Father Gómez.
"The police?"
"You saw them," said Dr. Huerta. "They were the ones trying to arrest you for smuggling drugs after you fought the killers who attacked you on your last visit."
"Then it has to be the National Police in Guatemala City," Sam said. Dr. Huerta said,
"I just spoke with them on my satellite phone. They said they would send an inspector to take our statements next month, 2 months at the latest."
"One inspector?" Sam said.
"Yes."
"Oh, by the way," said Father Gómez, "I brought you these."
He took the 2 pistols and 2 spare magazines out of his coat pockets and handed them to Sam and Remy.
"Thank you," said Remy.
"Your car is ready too," said Pepe.
"No charge.
I'm sorry for what we did to you. Maybe when you're back in the big world, you'll tell people we weren't so bad."
The door opened, and the crowd parted to let a small group of townspeople enter the clinic. Sam and Remy recognized many of them. Señor Alvarez, the restaurateur, seemed to have been chosen as a spokesman.
"Señor and Señora Fargo," he said.
"What just happened was exactly what you said would happen. Those men came from the Estancia Guerrero. Instead of asking to look at the old stronghold peacefully, they made us watch them murder the mayor. They're going to take our town and the stronghold and even our homes and families. We won't ever be able to complain because they'll keep us deep in the estancia. If we try to get help, they can kill all of us, and there will be nobody left to say what happened. We were wondering. I know it's more than anyone has a right to ask. If you would stay and help us fight."
Remy said, "After what just happened? Of course we'll stay."
"I have to warn you that we're not soldiers," said Sam, "but we'll do everything we can to help."
Dr. Huerta said,
"You fought the men who were guarding the marijuana fields and won. Just the 2 of you."
"They attacked us. We defended ourselves for a while, and then we got away. That's not winning."
"You killed a dozen of them, and you're just fine," Huerta said. "I call that a victory. A big one."
Sam said, "I don't think we'd have much chance against these people in a fight. They're heavily armed with modern weapons. They're trained and organized, and they've clearly fought before. Our best chance is to keep trying to get the authorities to protect the town.
I agree, said Dr. Huerta.
I hope we can, and we will keep trying. But we should also be ready to fight.
Yes, said Señor Alvarez. We're all willing to fight, but all we have is 5 days before they come back. We need to start preparing.
I'll get started by making a few phone calls, said Sam. He put an arm around Remy's waist, and they stepped toward the door.
But you're going to stay? Said Dr. Huerta.
Remy said, you bet we are. When he's all gruff like that, it means he's digging in.
Thanks, Sam said.
Just don't get in any more trouble for now.
No, we've got enough to last us. Sam hung up and called the number of the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala City. He identified himself and asked for Amy Costa. In a surprisingly short time, he heard Amy's voice.
Sam, she said. Good to hear from you. Is everything all right?
I'm afraid not, Sam said. We're in the town of Santa Maria de los Montañas, maybe 20 miles west of the Estancia Guerrero. He told her about the truckload of armed men arriving, the demands, and the murder.
Oh, Sam, she said. I can hardly believe this.
You said they gave the town a deadline. What is it? They said they'd be back in 5 days to get the signed agreements and presumably to move the townspeople to barracks on the Estancia. But it doesn't seem to matter much to these guys how the town gets vacated. They drilled the mayor in front of 200 witnesses.
5 days, Amy said. It's the worst possible timing.
Commander Rueda is the only one we can count on to react the way we want, and he's suspended for the next 30 days.
I'm sure that isn't a coincidence. Sarah Allersby makes her own coincidences, said Amy.
Can you get us any help?
I'll try.
But the high-ranking officers all know what happened when Rueda agreed to go after Sarah Allersby. It will take time to get somebody else to stick his neck out.
Sam said, do you know of any way we can get some weapons to defend the town?
Amy said, weapons?
I'm sorry, but involvement in unauthorized firearms transactions would get the embassy expelled from the country. And it would require going all the way up the chain of command to get permission at the highest levels. Some of my superiors don't see Sarah Allersby as our business. They think the locals should take care of her. Let's just hope the townspeople are still alive when that happens.
Chapter 29. The Estancia Guerrero. Sarah Allersby was waiting in the old counting house, a relic from the days of the Guerreros. She sat at the biggest of the old desks, directly under a ceiling fan operated by a belt attached to a long shaft along the ceiling and turned from outside the building, originally by hand, but now by electric motor. She sat back, closed her eyes, and took a couple of deep breaths to relax. Russell had telephoned her a half hour ago, so she guessed they were almost here by now. Soon she heard the sound of the truck gearing down on the highway, then making the turn onto the drive. It still amazed her how quiet the Estancia could be. There was noise whenever there was a flurry of work, harvest, planting, or shipping, but for weeks on end there was almost no sound out here. She stood, stepped up to a window that faced the forest, and looked at her reflection in the glass. She wore a loose white silk blouse, a pair of fitted black slacks with black knee-high riding boots, and a black flat-brimmed hat that hung down her back from its stampede string. She adjusted the black leather belt on her hips so the gun hung lower on the right, as though she were about to engage in a quick-draw gunfight. She stepped outside onto the wooden porch, her leather boot heels making a hard clicking noise on the boards. The truck grumbled up the gravel drive and stopped in front of her. Men jumped down from the truck bed. They looked impressive to her, all carrying AK-47 knockoffs, most of them armed with fighting knives in sheaths. They stood in a wavering line beside their truck and looked at her expectantly. Russell and Ruiz jumped down from the cab and approached her.
She said, "You sounded on the phone as though it went well."
"I guess it did," said Russell. "We herded them outside and gave them the message."
"Good,"